Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you everyone for being here with us again on a Sunday morning. And thanks to WREN for providing Sunday morning wake-up call with a home. Today's show, Title IX and its impact on sports. As it approaches its 50th anniversary, our guest, Professor Bonnie Hagerman, she's at UVA's Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality. Professor Hagerman has degrees from Princeton University, Ohio University. Her PhD dissertation, Skimpy Coverage, examines Sports Illustrated's treatment of sportswomen in its pages from 1954 to the year 2000. And since joining UVA, Professor Hagerman has been teaching the course Women, Gender, and Sport, A History of American Female Athletes for more than a decade now. Professor Hagerman, thanks for being here with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Title IX, approaching its 50th anniversary, for sports fans somewhat familiar with Title IX, but I'd like you to start by explaining exactly what Title IX is for all listeners.
Sure. So Title IX is part of the Education Amendment that was passed in 1972. And really, Title IX was passed with an eye towards kind of fulfilling what the Civil Rights Act of 1964 didn't cover. So that when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, it addressed issues of discrimination in terms of race, ethnicity, and sex, but it particularly in terms of employment, but it didn't cover education specifically. And so Title IX sought to redress that. And so the issue was really focusing on access for females to apply to college and get into college, and also for female professors to have equal access to be hired, to be paid equally, that kind of thing. So when Title IX is passed in 1972, it's, you know, 35 words that basically say no program receiving federal, no educational program receiving federal assistance, there should be no discrimination there. And so it's very broad. One of the interesting things I talk about in my classes is we take a look at this 35-word law, and nowhere in it are sports mentioned. There are programs, educational programs, but sports specifically is not mentioned. And when Title IX is passed, when there's discussion about Title IX in Congress, sports was really brought up only a couple of times and kind of dismissed. Nobody's really talking about its application to sports until it actually gets passed. And then there's all sorts of concerns about how Title IX might actually affect sports, not only at the collegiate level, but also at the high school level as well. So the passage of Title IX in 1972, which you're absolutely correct, we're coming up on its 50th anniversary, is really designed to address issues more broadly within an educational setting.
Was there some sort of landmark moment that made someone in the political realm go, hey, we didn't bring in the educational part of the Civil Rights Act?
Well, so it's interesting. Between 1970 and 1971, Bernice Sandler filed more than 250 lawsuits against colleges and universities charging sexual discrimination in hiring. And this really came to the attention of Oregon Congresswoman Edith Green, who started holding initial hearings about Title IX, about the need to enact Title IX. And so it's really, I would credit certainly Bernice Sandler, Edith Green, and then, of course, Representative Patsy Mink from Hawaii, who is Title IX's kind of major author and sponsor. But the importance of Title IX is, of course, coming at a time of the second wave feminist movement, too, where you're beginning to see more interest, late 1960s, early 1970s, in movement in specifically in terms of legal action, trying to redress issues of inequity and inequality where women are concerned, kind of in a broader American culture.
So in terms of sports, how did it get brought into that category? If sports is not mentioned in the original Title IX, would you say 36 words?
Yeah, so it's any federal, so any educational program. And of course, you know, you're talking about educational programs. Let's take college, for example. You can talk about it in terms of drama. You can talk about it in terms of marching bands. These are all programs that are under the university of umbrella. And of course, you know, for our purposes today, talking about sports, this, of course, is a huge, huge category. So Title IX was really designed to be pretty broad. And I think its authors understood that there would be major opposition if sports were specifically mentioned. And it's broad with a particular design. Title IX gets passed, and then they start hashing out the rules. And pretty quickly, you have forces moving to remove sports from Title IX's purview. Texas Senator John Tower tried to pass an amendment that basically said, look, you know, fine, Title IX, great, but it shouldn't apply to sports. And that amendment got defeated. And then he said, okay, fine. But it can apply to sports. And then he came back and said, but it shouldn't apply to revenue-producing sports. And, of course, the big concern here was what would happen to particularly football, men's football, and how would men's sports in particular be affected by the passage of Title IX.
Right, because that's been an issue for almost 50 years, and we'll get to that throughout the hour. Professor Bonnie Hagerman here from UVA's Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality. As we talk about Title IX and its impact on sports as it approaches its 50th anniversary, how was Title IX received by the majority of schools, at least stated in public?
So this is interesting because you mentioned my work on Sports Illustrated. Sports Illustrated has a number of articles about Title IX, and particularly, they talk about athletic directors saying, so Title IX is passed in 1972. They hash out the rules and regulations. It takes them 3 years to kind of come to consensus. Those are passed by 1975. And then there is a 3-year grace period for schools to comply. And the bottom line is that most schools, particularly most colleges and universities, accept some kind of federal funding, whether it's you have students who are accepting federal student loans, whether you've got faculty who are applying for federally funded grants. if you accept a dime of federal funding in any way, shape, or form, you have to comply with Title IX. So for most colleges and universities, Title IX compliance then becomes a real issue. That's not as much the case for high schools. Public high schools, of course, have to because they are receiving federal funding. But private schools at the high school level do not have to comply with Title IX. But for athletic directors who are now faced with the passage of Title IX, many of them are really saying, look, we understand that Title IX has passed, but you need to give us more time. We need time to be able to figure things out. We need time to be able to get up to speed. You're not giving us enough wiggle room here to make the kinds of changes we need to make. When in fact, you know, Title IX passed in 1972, the rules were ironed out by 1975, and schools do not have to be officially in compliance until 1978. And I think this is a lot of, for some of them, certainly it was an adjustment. For others, it was just a real disinterest in complying. And we see that continuing to happen in schools, not only in the late 1970s, but in the 21st century as well.
How about the general public? What were the general public's thoughts and feedback on Title IX in the early 70s?
Well, I think that it depends on who you talk to. Those who were interested in men's sports saw it as a real threat to men's sports. The NCAA hated it. The NCAA, in fact, in 1976, when it became clear that the rules and regulations had been ironed out, actually brought a suit against to try to overturn Title IX, basically saying that Title IX shouldn't apply to Title IX should only apply to those departments within schools that receive federal funding, and instead of the entire school itself. So the NCAA was basically trying to do an end run around Title IX because very few athletic programs actually get federal funds directly. It's the schools overall. And that suit was thrown out in 1976 because the NCAA didn't have any standing. But for those of your listeners who are familiar with what happened during the Final Four basketball tournament for the women and the very inequitable facilities, particularly in terms of the weight room that were provided in that NCAA tournament, this is not going to come as a big surprise that the NCAA had really opposed the passage of Title IX. But I think what might be interesting for your readers to know is that, you know, in 1971 and 1972, right before Title IX is passed, not quite 30,000 women played college sports, and about 300,000, not quite 300,000 high school females played sports across the entire country. By about 2005, those numbers had just increased exponentially. By 2005, almost 3 million girls were playing high school sports, and almost 167,000 women are playing collegiate sports. That's a 900% increase at the high school level, and not quite a 500% increase at the collegiate level. So the bottom line is that Title IX was really needed, and a lot of women took advantage of it. So there was a lot of support, certainly, for it among those who were interested in women's sports.
Would you consider Title IX successful if you're I mean, if you're only basing it on the number of women, high school and college, university age, participating in sports, and then you're telling me that the numbers participating have increased by 900% or 500% in 40 years, then it seems overwhelmingly successful. But if you're bringing in other factors, are you telling me that it's a successful, fully successful program?
I'd say it's amazingly successful. Of course, there are issues that we need to pay attention to with Title IX, particularly in terms of race. I would say that a lot of the women, and there's been a number, a bunch of people, William Roden talked about this in an article for the New York Times. Tina Sloan Green, who's a co-founder of the Black Women's Sports Foundation, talked about the fact that a lot of women, regardless of race, have benefited from Title IX, particularly athletes have benefited from Title IX. But a lot of those sports that have been added to satisfy Title IX are overwhelmingly populated by white female athletes. That's particularly true in terms of, for example, crew, volleyball, lacrosse. Those are overwhelmingly dominated by white women. Soccer, for example. And when you talk about sports that are populated by black women, certainly that's the case for basketball and track and field, but you see those percentages almost non-existent in other sports. Lacrosse, swimming, soccer, volleyball, softball, for example. So I think that when we talk about successes in terms of Title IX and areas that we still need to be thoughtful about, certainly race is one of those issues. One of the unintended consequences of Title IX was the loss of female coaches of women's sports teams. With the passage of Title IX, you saw a more equitable distribution in terms of facilities, in terms of participation. You also saw that in terms of salaries for women's coaches as well. So now it became a lot more lucrative to become a coach of a women's sports team. So before Title IX passed, 90% plus of all female sports teams are coached by women. Now that number is 40-something. I want to say 46 or 47%. So it was just one of those kind of unintended outcomes of Title IX. The other situation, too, is that before Title IX is passed, a number of schools often had an athletic director for its women's sports programs and an athletic director for its men's sports programs. Once Title IX is passed, those programs are collapsed into one, and usually the male athletic directors became the head of the entire program. And so we see also women struggling to catch up in terms of governance, in terms of administration. And certainly UVA, with its female athletic coordinator, is leading the way.
Excellent. Our guest today, Professor Bonnie Hagerman, UVA's Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality, as she's teaching us about Title IX and its impact on sports as Title IX approaches its 50th anniversary. Join us back here in just a moment. And thank you so much for being here with us on a Sunday morning, as those of us who are sports fans and those of us who are not are learning about Title IX, things we didn't know, and its impact on sports. Professor Hagerman, Bonnie Hagerman with us. Professor, we've we've sort of gone out. You were talking before the break about how many of the programs that were added to help meet the requirements, and I think you used the word populated, were populated by effectively by white women. And so they were leaving out, and it was not equal benefits provided by females of ethnic backgrounds. What sports could universities and high schools do a better job with?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think access. I'm not sure it's necessarily sport specific, as opposed to the importance of having access and opportunity to those sports. So it's one of the stories that about that particular issue, I think that is important, comes from Brianna Scurry, who was the goalkeeper for the 1999 Women's World Cup team that, of course, famously filled the Rose Bowl for the final and won it in overtime and penalty kicks, with Brandi Chastain being triumphant, kicking that final kick. And Brianna Scurry was notable because she was one of just a couple of women of color on that 99er team, which was seen as kind of the fruition of Title IX. Title IX, Mia Hamm, who was the star of that team, one of the stars of that team, I should say, was born in 1972. So a lot of people saw this 1999 American women's soccer team as embodying the success of Title IX. Here's Title IX coming of age. And Brianna Scurry really talked about the importance of having access to sports and the opportunity to play sports, in terms of, you know, not only financial access, but actual, you know, programs that are available at various different schools and recruitment. And I think when we talk about, when we look at the Olympics and we think about Simone Manuel, for example, who is an American Olympic swimmer, and the fact that she was seen as kind of this singular exception to a rule that, you know, so many of the, particularly the American swimmers, female swimmers were white, a lot of that has to do with continued effects of segregation when Black Americans didn't have access to pools, when lakes were roped off from them, and this was particularly in the South, or pools charged access fees that were high enough to prevent certain people from being able to access those facilities. So I think it's these kinds of things that we need to reconsider as we're talking about sports and making sure, particularly at the middle school and the high school level, that there's equal access and equal opportunity for everybody.
You mentioned the women's national soccer team. This is a good time to bring in the gender pay gap in sports. I read something in doing my homework for today that tennis was considered one of the first sports to close the pay gap between male and female athletes. Your thoughts on that?
That's absolutely true. I would say that women's professional tennis is probably a gold standard in terms of for other sports, women's professional sports. The WNBA is catching up, but of course, I mean, when you look at rookie salaries in terms of the WNBA and the NBA, there's just, I mean, the difference is, of course, just ridiculous. But it's important to remember that Title IX doesn't really have anything to do with professional sports. And it's also important to, I think, remember that even if we consider tennis the gold standard, Wimbledon did not actually pay women and men equally until 2007. So a lot of us are going to remember that Billie Jean King really, really put the pay gap issue kind of onto our agenda in the United States, fighting for equal pay, founding her, a separate tour to really highlight the need and to pressure tennis officials to do that. But it really, she passed the baton, and Venus Williams actually picked that up. And there's a fabulous documentary, ESPN documentary called Venus Versus, which talks about Venus's activism. We were familiar, very familiar with, I think, Serena Williams's activism, but Venus was heavily involved in pushing for equal pay at Wimbledon. And finally, Wimbledon decided to do that in 2007 after saying, no, they couldn't do that because it might hurt their flower budget. You know, they wouldn't be able to have as many purple and white flowers at Wimbledon if they paid women equally. I mean, it was just, and the difference was just insulting by the end. And so finally Wimbledon, came through in 2007. But so it's only been 15 years, really, not even quite, where we've seen even women's professional tennis, we've seen equitable pay, and that's particularly at the Grand Slam tournaments.
Well, there's still, you and I have both mentioned the U.S. women's soccer team. There's still a lawsuit, correct, trying for the women's national soccer team to get equal pay as the men's, although, I would say often, if not frequently or always, the women's team outdraws the men's team.
That's certainly true. I think they've certainly captured a lot of fans' interest, and their success certainly has been higher than that of the men's. A lot of that, I think, also has to do not only with the U.S. Soccer Federation and deciding how they're going to pay and to compensate their players, but also has to do a lot with FIFA as well, which is the international sports body, governing body for international soccer. And the bottom line is that FIFA came late to hosting a World Cup for women, and they simply do not compensate women along the same lines as they compensate men. And you know, a lot of this is complicated by various countries that have outright banned soccer, women from playing soccer. In Brazil, women couldn't play soccer officially until like 1980. So we're talking specifically about the American women and their struggles for equitable pay, but it also is it's an international issue, not only in terms of pay, but in terms of access as well. And what I think is really interesting also is that the American women are not only fighting their own fight, but inspiring other countries, other women in other countries to also kind of model what they're doing and also fighting for equitable treatment for their national women's soccer teams as well.
So let me get back to Title IX and the college and high school sports. We are talking about Title IX and its impact on sports. Title IX is approaching its 50th anniversary, as our guest today is Professor Bonnie Hagerman, UVA's Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality. Professor, how do today's athletic departments, because I think the majority of folks who have an awareness of Title IX associate it with college athletics, how do you make it work? Are you just splitting the money and the scholarships 50-50?
So at the NCAA is really governs scholarships. So that they kind of lay that out. But what's important to remember about Title IX is that we're talking about equity and not equality. And those two concepts, while I think sometimes people use them interchangeably, are very different. And one of the, so we spoke earlier about when Title IX is passed, Senator Tower tries to get sports exempted essentially from Title IX's purview. That doesn't happen. But one of the amendments that is passed is the Javits Amendment. And the Javits Amendment basically says, look, we're talking about an equitable distribution of funds, not an equal distribution of funds. So, for example, under Title IX, we need to have women's sports programs, but we need to fund those equitably. They need to have access to coaching. They need to have access to equipment, to facilities, to travel schedules that are equitable to men's teams. But if you take the women's tennis team, for example, I'm not even sure. I think there might be 20 women. And we take UVA's example because the women's tennis team is really quite great. In fact, I had a student of mine who was on the tennis team. At any rate, 20 women are playing tennis, let's say, for the UVA women's tennis team, and over 100 men are playing on UVA's football team. So the question back in the 1970s, as they're hammering out these rules, are do you give funding to the women's tennis team that is equal to the men's football team? And the answer with the Javits Amendment is no, because you got 100 people on the men's football team, and you've got 20 women on the tennis team. So the women's tennis team doesn't need as much funding as the men's football team. So we need an equitable distribution of funds. They need to have the same kind of travel schedule. They need to have the same kinds of access to coaching that the men's football team does, but they don't need to have the same the same exact amount of funding that the men's football team does, because the equipment is different, the number of roster spots is different. So that's an important piece to keep in mind. We're talking about equity and not about equality.
Can you talk a little bit more about the revenue sports? Because that is often used, even today. You talked about it being an initial argument about exempting the revenue sports, but it still comes up today. And I read the phrase, pitting the victims against the victims, tightening the budgets of non-revenue men's sports with the excuse that women's sports and Title IX are the cause, which was something along the lines of, hey, we can't have this non-revenue men's sports in our program anymore because we're forced to keep this non-revenue women's sport. So sorry, folks, turn over there and blame the women. So can you talk about that for a bit?
Sure. And you're absolutely correct. The revenue-producing sports, they were the issue back in the early 1970s, and they remain an issue today. So there's a couple of things, I think, that we need to remember, which is when we talk about revenue-producing sports, we're often talking about football, occasionally basketball too, but really we're talking about football. And while there are some football programs, the football programs absolutely make money. There's no question about that. The question is, do they make enough to offset their costs? Do they make a profit? So they're absolutely revenue producing. And when you talk about revenue, you're talking about not only ticket sales, but you're also talking about alumni donations and the like. So for a lot of the men's sports, those are revenue producing. The question is whether or not they are profit making. And not every football program, in fact, I would argue that only a few football programs, maybe 20 come to mind, actually make a serious profit. And so that's one thing to keep in mind. The second thing is that when we're talking about Title IX compliance, we're talking about programs, educational programs. And the bottom line is that football is part of an educational program. Collegiate football runs through universities and colleges, and thus they, you know, that program is just as important as, say, men's wrestling. And the other thing to keep in mind here is that nobody is telling the athletic department, oh, hey, you have to cut men's sport, what they call minor men's sports, to fund women's sports. Everybody's making those decisions for themselves. And I think what's also really interesting early on is that Sports Illustrated writers in the 1970s and 1980s into the 1990s talked about the fact that in trying to kind of dismiss concerns about Title IX, oh, Title IX killing off minor men's sports, that's really not the case. And that, you know, oh, football should be protected at any cost because it's the one that makes all of the money for all of the rest of the programs. That's not always the case. And if we're talking about it as an educational program, we can't argue that men's football is necessarily going to be more important, experience for its athletes than men's wrestling. So, you know, I think it's important to keep in mind that we're talking about extracurricular activities for everybody. And one of the things that Sports Illustrated writers talked about was limiting roster spots. Having football teams roster only a certain number of spots and making that a rule. Have the NCAA enforce that. Because what I think is important also to realize for your listeners is that there are three different ways to actually satisfy Title IX compliance. And one of the biggest, myths that I seek to dispel in my classes is I have students who say, oh, you have to fulfill all of these three rules about complying with Title IX. That's not the case. There are three different ways to fulfill Title IX. And the first one is using quota, what they see as the quotas. And that's basically proportionality. Using the percentage of your student body, so if you have 55% of females as your student body, then about 55% of your female student athletes should also be reflected. And that's not usually the case. For example, at UVA, we have about 55% of the student body being female, when about 45% or so of the female of the athletes are females. So in that particular case, UVA would not be using proportionality to satisfy Title IX compliance.
Professor Hagerman, let's take our break and then come back, and you can keep going with the rest of these, because I want to know. I only thought there was the one way, so you're going to have to tell us about the others. Title IX and its impact on sports as it approaches its 50th anniversary with UVA professor Bonnie Hagerman. Hang tight. And here we are, Sunday morning wake-up call. Professor Hagerman, you were telling us about the three different ways to fulfill Title IX compliance. And number one was, I thought, the only way to do it. What are numbers two and three?
Sure. So a lot of people kind of get stuck on that first one, which is proportionality. When you hear Title IX being referred to as a quota system, that's usually what people think of, that, oh, it's proportionality, and if you have 55% of your women as students, then 55% of your athletes need to be women as well. So that represents one of the three prongs, as they're described in Title IX lingo. It's also the hardest one to satisfy. So really very few schools actually satisfy Title IX compliance using the first prong. Those schools that do often do not have football teams because the roster spots in football teams are so high, 100 people, 120 people, you don't have the kind of sports, women's sports, to offset that. The addition of women's crew at a lot of colleges really throughout the 1980s, even into the 21st century, represents schools and universities and colleges trying to attempt to offset that that imbalance, because for women's crew, they're adding usually 60, sometimes 70 spots, which of course still leaves you at a disadvantage. So prong two actually is showing as a school that you have a history of adding sports programs for women. So I'll take UVA again as an example. They added women's crew, late 1990s, early 2000s, as I recall. They also added golf in the early 2000s. And then more recently, they've added squash. So in terms of satisfying Title IX, if you can show that you've added programs pretty consistently to your pro, and it, again, doesn't have to be every year, and there doesn't seem to be a rule like, oh, you have to add a sport every 5 years or every 7 years, but just a consistent history of providing opportunities, additional opportunities for women to play sports, allows you to be in compliance. So this history of providing sports programs. And the other thing to remember, I think, that's important is that when we talk about Title IX, we're talking about the underrepresented sex. That again is the phrasing in the Title IX law. So for women's colleges that have gone co-ed, at those colleges, men are the underrepresented sex. And there have been Title IX cases, not very many of them, but there have been Title IX cases that have been brought by men as the underrepresented sex. So the prong one is proportionality, prong two is history, and then prong three is basically proving that you have accommodated the interests of athletes at your school. So if nobody's saying, hey, I want to play a certain sport and I'm representing the underrepresented sex, then you are set to go. So for a lot of colleges who are in compliance with Title IX, they are most likely using either prong two, which again is having a history of adding sports for the underrepresented sex, or prong three, which is proving that, yep, we don't have anybody who's come to us as a member of the underrepresented sex who wants to have a sporting opportunity.
Professor Hagerman, how has UVA been doing overall in your mind, and have they ever been noted for, I guess the phrase would be something similar to failure to meet the mandate?
Yeah, I think certainly the addition of teams has been really important, of crew and of golf and of squash. I think one of the really important additions has been the women's softball stadium. I think that's been a really important addition that could have been seen as perhaps problematic where Title IX was concerned. I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar. They played down, the women's team played down, I think at the park. I think they call it the park. It's down by the JAG school. And if anybody's familiar with that area, the fields are great, but they're certainly not anything near the men's baseball stadium and the facilities there. And the women's softball stadium that just recently was constructed and the construction was finished really goes a long way to closing, I think, an important gap. So I think with those kinds of that kind of attention to sports and to facilities has been really important.
Again, Professor Bonnie Hagerman with us as we talk about Title IX and its impact on sports. Professor, in the past year and a half or so with COVID-19, it seems to have brought back this issue about loss of revenue sports and who's not bringing in revenue, but you used the phrase earlier about actually making profit. I go back to William and Mary over this time that removed some women's teams because there was loss of income from fan attendance at the college football games. Has that come up more frequently over the past year and a half, 2 years?
I think certainly COVID has put an emphasis on Title IX. I also think that this is a real opportunity for American colleges and universities to take a real look at how they're spending money. I think there's a real arms race in terms of facilities, in terms of, particularly in terms of facilities for men's football, basketball, and the need to recruit would-be players with juice bars and video game lounges and just amazing kinds of spa-like services. And I think it's maybe time to really kind of take a hard look at how we are prioritizing spending those funds. Because I think if we, again, Sports Illustrated writers talked about roster spots and reducing roster spots. If we can kind of come to an agreement about just how many perks certain sports offer, that would really free up money for other sports, and not just women's sports, but men's sports as well. And I think what gets missed here with Title IX is that the concern about the passage of Title IX was you're going to have more women playing sports than ever before, but you're going to have a reduction in the number of men who play sports. When I talked about the increase of women over time, particularly between 1971 and 2006, I talked about the increased percentage of participation among women. Men also, over time, we've seen an increase in participation among men as well. So, the women certainly had a farther way to go. At the collegiate level, we see the increase among women at 450%, almost 500%. Among men, it's an increase of 31%. So while many people see Title IX as really being a problem for sports, for men's sports in general, we see this as an opportunity to see the sporting experience being enhanced in general for both men and women. And I think that we could have maybe some really interesting conversations about curbing the arms race for some of these other sports so that we can allow everybody to enjoy a collegiate athletic experience.
Professor, we've been talking about Title IX and its impact on sports almost completely. And again, as a sports fan, that's been my awareness of Title IX, I was surprised to regularly find mention of Title IX with the term sexual violence and sexual discrimination. Can you talk about why that phrase and those words keep coming up in the discussion about Title IX?
Sure. So when I was in college and grad school in the late 90s, early 2000s, the focus, you know, when we talked about Title IX, you were usually talking about it with regard to sports. What I think is really interesting now, and in fact, I talk about this too in my classes, is that when we talk about Title IX now, we're really talking about it in terms of sexual assault, in terms of violence against women, and the protections that colleges and universities need to enact to protect women on grounds. And again, this really goes back, harkens back to the law that Title IX actually is, Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972, which was designed to reduce discrimination against women in an educational setting. So I think this, certainly the focus on sexual violence is a really, really important one. And it's an important one for schools across the nation.
Is there anything similar in other countries around the world, similar to the U.S. Title IX?
It's a great question. There are other countries that have certainly women's sports organizations, much like the Women's Sports Foundation. And I'd encourage your listeners to access the Women's Sports Foundation for information on Title IX and other issues related to women's sports. I think I sent you those links as part of your homework for today. And it's a good source for people to learn about Title IX and the importance of Title IX. And we've seen other countries pass kinds of similar, I think, laws and pay attention to the importance of female athletes. But I really do believe Title IX is unique just because of the major difference in sports for women before Title IX and after Title IX. There's a story by the legendary Pat Summitt, who for years was the head coach of the women's basketball team at the University of Tennessee, and really along with Gina Auriemma and the University of Connecticut women's basketball team, brought college women basketball, I think, really into prime time with their rivalry. Pat Summitt talked about when she was coaching the women's basketball team before Title IX, she not only coached the team, but she taped ankles, she washed the uniforms, she drove the team van, and Jane Miller, who was an assistant athletic director at the University of Virginia, talked about being the head coach for the lacrosse team at UVA, women's lacrosse team, and going out before games with a can of baby powder and shaking the powder on the field to outline the field of play. These were the responsibilities of head coaches. So when we talk about pre-Title IX and now post-Title IX, the landscape is just so incredibly different, not only in terms of obviously participation rates, but also in terms of responsibilities for coaches, and just, I think the difference is just so compelling.
We've got about 3 minutes left here with Professor Hagerman talking about Title IX and its impact on sports. I ran across a statistic: girls who participate in sports are likely to do better in schools, graduate from high school at a higher rates, enjoy life longer with healthier benefits. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, in fact, Nike, I believe, did a commercial using those statistics. It's called If You Let Me Play. You know, I'll be X percentage more likely to be successful, to stay in school, not to get pregnant, to be healthier. And there were, it was a really, I think, interesting campaign. And I think it's also telling that Billie Jean King, also a big proponent, has been a big supporter of Title IX, of course, and this combination of, you know, second wave feminism and sport and the intersection of that, really we see with Title IX and the benefits that accrue, not only in terms of high school and collegiate sport, but professional sports, Olympic sports as well. And I'd say that certainly a lot of the American women who were successful in the Olympic Games, many of them got their start through sports that were supported by Title IX.
I read a comment that Billie Jean King was actually one of the sort of faces for Title IX, because she was number one in 1973 on the professional women's circuit and would not play in the U.S. Open until it would guarantee pay equity, and then it did.
Yeah, you know, I love Billie Jean King, and I certainly believe that her work in terms of equal pay on the tennis tour, the battle of the sexes with Bobby Riggs in 1973, both of those were huge, huge developments for women's sports. Neither of them really had anything to do with Title IX, again, because professional women's sports don't have anything to do with federal funding from programs. And that's really, again, the important thing to remember is that we're talking about sports programs that receive federal funding and need to be thus in compliance with Title IX. But I think Billie Jean King's achievements certainly underscore the importance of women's sports and having access to those sports, which, of course, Title IX helps to assure.
Professor Bonnie Hagerman today talking about Title IX and its impact on sports as Title IX approaches its 50th anniversary. Professor Hagerman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.